All right, guys, thank you for being here. Thank you for your patience. We're so happy to have you third panel of the day. Welcome to PolitiFest. I'm Bella Ross, social media producer for Voice of San Diego. We are a nonprofit investigative news organization. Nonprofit meaning we need support from people. You guys are already partaking in that, which is great. There are other ways to support us. Regardless, we appreciate you being here, and we're excited to get into this topic today. I'd like to take a minute to recognize our sponsors who helped to make this event possible. A special thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of San Diego for being our partner for 7 years now. Our thanks to the Saquon Band of the Kumeyaay Nation, the United Domestic Workers Union, AARP, the San Diego Foundation, Business for Good, Pitsky Development, the San Diego Municipal Employees Association, the Asian Business Association, Planned Parenthood of the Pacific Southwest, Atlantis Group, and the Southern California Rental Housing Association. We'd also like to recognize KPBS and iNews Source, our partners in Public Matters. Public Matters is a collaborative that we will be embarking on through the election season and beyond. We're going to be doing a lot of content together, sharing content to hopefully get more election information in the hands of voters and empower you all to engage in the democratic process. So that's going to be really cool, something to look forward to. And this is very much a part of that today, because KPBS has done a lot of coverage on incivility in public meetings. And with that, I'm going to hand this off to Will Hunsberry.
Surprise.
Whoa!
That's all right. We know a little about incivility in politics as well, Voice of San Diego. So, Jay was supposed to do this. I'm doing this, but I'm a reporter. All I do is ask questions. I think I can handle it. But I am going to let y'all introduce yourselves, if you wouldn't mind, since I was not exactly prepared to do that. So, Carl, can you start us off?
Sure. I'm Carl Luna. Is that working? Here we go. My name is Carl Luna. I'm a professor emeritus of political science at San Diego Mesa College. I'm a visiting professor here at USD. And I'm also the director of the Institute for Civil Civic Engagement at USD San Diego Community College District Partnership. And we've been working on trying to build civility for about 15 years, and you can see we've done a bang-up job.
We agreed to share mics because we both have colds. I'm LaWanna Richmond. I am the board vice president for Alliance San Diego. I'm a EV program manager, operations manager at UC San Diego, and I'm the executive director and founder of Greeners Inc., a nonprofit 501c3 that's devoted to engineering the future through storytelling. And I guess I should add, I'm an Afrofuturist, so that's the lens through which I view everything.
Hi, I'm, can everyone hear me? Yeah, okay, great. I'm Tara Lawson-Reamer, Vice Chair of the San Diego County Board of Supervisors. I'm by training an economist and an attorney. And for those who don't know, I was previously in a former life university educator, reform professor. So great to be here and excited to talk about this topic.
Hi everyone, I'm David Loy. I'm legal director of the First Amendment Coalition, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to defending freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the people's right to know.
Okay, thank y'all for joining us. I was hoping we could start with you, Supervisor Lawson-Reamer. You know, since meetings went online, the nature of public meetings has changed a lot, as I'm sure everybody in this room has witnessed. You know, what we hear at those meetings gets pretty intense and wild sometimes, and I think nowhere more so than the county, maybe. So can you, like, set the stage for us a little and talk about what the meetings have been like at the Board of Supervisors in the past few years and some of the most intense experiences you remember?
Sure. I'd first like to better understand the baseline knowledge of the folks in the room. How many people have watched at least one county supervisor meeting in the last 3.5 years? Okay, how many have watched? Maybe 5. Okay. How many have gone in person? How many have gone in person multiple times? How many, yeah, thank you, Paul. How many people would like to go in person multiple times? So I think to me, this is really the jumping off point. I mean, from my point of view, the whole purpose of having public meetings that are Brown Act meetings that are on the record, that are open, where people can come, they can watch deliberations happening, they can hold their elected officials accountable for the choices they make, the decisions they make, but they also have an opportunity to make their positions and their voice seen and heard. I think the fundamental core purpose of these meetings is to ensure that all of our constituents have the right to participate and have the ability to participate in a constructive manner and be part of the public dialogue, be part of this collective process of decision making. And I think for me, that's kind of the jumping off point in general, just the first principle. And I think what's been going on at our public meetings over the last couple of years is really a collapsing of the public space, a collapsing of the ability of the vast majority of the public to participate, to feel comfortable in participating, feel comfortable showing up, willing to even listen or call in, because of kind of an atmosphere of like real aggression and hostility and toxicity that's often directed towards at other people in the room, other testifiers, other commenters, certainly county staff. There's certainly been a very strong uptick in racist comments, anti-Semitic comments, things that are just frankly obscene and not relevant to the matter at hand, not actually topically relevant to the items that are being discussed, that are sort of ad hominem attacks on, you know, one thing to have an attack on me, I'm an elected representative, you know, maybe not pleasant, but that's kind of just the job. But very different when these are being directed towards other members of the public and county staff. So I think you all who have witnessed it, I think know what I'm talking about, but this is what I think has really been going on is, a creation of an environment that's mostly about personal attacks or often about personal attacks is like very toxic and I think has made it very difficult to have substantive conversations about the subject matters that are very important to our community that we are there to deliberate.
Right.
And I think just to wrap it up, I don't know that I necessarily trace it to online versus offline, whatnot. I think that you can see this increase in toxicity and sort of like personally driven attacks that aren't really about the issues. Really when Donald Trump ran for office since 2016, I feel like, although I should defer to Carl on the data and those kinds of questions. But from my anecdotal experience, I would say that is what I'm seeing and yeah.
So I'm going to go to Luana next, who has run for school board as well. She's also been close to these public meetings. You know, when you've heard some of these racist attacks in public meetings by people, what do you feel like the answer potentially should be, you know, when we have this hateful speech occurring, but we also need to be able to address their governing bodies. How do you see that?
So, you know, we kind of get to the crux of why I ran for school board. Because a lot of it is we've moved away from the standards that we used to have of just basic decency. And in terms of the answer to it, a lot of it is moving into an era of accountability where we get into that tricky space with, you know, the free speech. And at the same time, you know, how do you, you know, winnow out justifiable indignation from attacks? And sometimes the two get conflated.
Right.
And I say that because you have people who are, many of them are coming to these meetings because you know, they're dealing with food insecurity, housing insecurity. They're dealing with real issues that affect their day-to-day lives. And so they're naturally gonna be emotional. And then that's conflated by people who are there because they have concerns that are less basic and more, I guess, personal and more more social in terms of demographic breakdowns and who you are, who not, in terms of putting people in boxes.
Right.
I think a big answer, I mean, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Human Dignity Campaign we started over a year ago with the Lion San Diego, where we've come to a place where we understand that a lot of what we're seeing is, you know, the pendulum swings, right? And so you have people who feel when you start talking about, especially DEI issues, that they're being left out. Because often when we start talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, we're breaking our focus, we're shifting our focus into a specific demographic group at the moment and their specific concerns. And everyone who doesn't fit in that box, you know, has whatever feelings they feel. Whereas when you make the conversation about human dignity and treating everyone with respect, I know it sounds a little all lives mattery, but it's not, trust me. It's really about, you know, returning to this place where we do have a baseline of civility, a baseline level of recognizing the humanity in each person that we come across.
It almost sounds like you're saying like a cultural change, though, potentially is what's necessary rather than limiting the discussion through rules somehow at public meetings.
Culture is going to eat strategy for lunch. So creating rules, no, anytime you create a rule, anyone who wants to break that rule is going to find a way to break the rule.
Right.
Whereas when you change a culture, when you do it in an effective way, it becomes a self-reinforcing thing.
Right.
As opposed to saying you can't do this or you can't do that, you focus on this is what we do, this is how we treat people.
Uh-huh.
And then we start to have members of the community holding each other accountable, kind of like a, oh no, we don't do that here.
Right.
You know, and, you know, like the commercial where you've seen like the person leave their wallet and their watch and everything on the hood of their car because the crime, there's no crime in their area,
mm-hmm.
and coming back and it's still there, because in there they've created a culture where if somebody's belongings are someplace, you don't touch their belongings. I mean, maybe because you might get your hand cut off.
Carl, let's go to you. What do you feel like is at stake here when we're having this discussion about this rise of incivility in public meetings and how we deal with it?
Well, Will, I think our whole process of government is at stake. But I'm
nothing big.
We've got democracy, our ability to function, we get basic policy done. But I'll go even a step farther than Luanda, because I think she's right. It's a cultural issue, and no amount of rule changing under the current format is going to fix that. I've progressively become more and more disenchanted with the entire way we do this process in this, the 21st century.
Okay.
We've got a public meeting process. What does that mean? It means whoever wants to show up can talk. In a county, what are we, 3 million in the county, 2 million in the city? You're gonna have louder voices, coordinated voices, trying to influence things. The vast majority of San Diegans are never gonna make it down to 202 C Street, and thank goodness if you've been in that council chamber, it's not a thing you wanna have to experience to make it down to the Board of Supervisors. They've got lives to live. The people who show up are typically either people who are part of the system, people who are average citizens trying to have their voice heard, but they get drowned out now increasingly by the people making all the noise. There is a deliberate effort to disrupt public meetings for political purposes. Supervisor Lawson Reamer, I think you participated in our research that we had done. We sent out to all the different elected officials, we being the Grop School of Peace Studies, our institute, we did a big survey about how are these threats and all affecting you, the disruptions you're feeling, and you had mentioned it's kind of like part of the job. It was always kind of there, but it was really around the pandemic. It just exploded. People found out that they could use public meetings to advance either a political agenda or to advance their own social media careers. You've got people going place to place just to look big on their social media feeds, and it crowds everybody else out. It's having an impact. A majority of people we've surveyed said they wonder why they went into public life and wouldn't recommend going into public life. And it's disproportionately 2-to-1 women are saying, I may leave public life because they're being hounded out. the process we have based on like the 19th, 18th century, we'll all come to the town hall and discuss things out. It's archaic. I just came out of the Digital Democracy Center session from Cal Matters. There are far better technologies out there to capture public opinion and public interest that would include all members of our community and not just the people who are making the most noise. We really need to re-envision what we're doing. The Brown Act exists for a reason. Insiders are making decisions. But the way we now have it, where everybody believes they have a right to say whatever they want, they're crowding out everybody else from the public space. It's a privilege to use public time. You want to write a letter to somebody, go right ahead. But to stand up on the things that our elected officials have to endure and the public has to endure, we need to draw a line, and the current system cannot be fixed to accommodate people who are willfully wanting to disrupt it.
So let me get to David real quick, if y'all don't mind. I want to hear about the solutions that you envision. Definitely, Carl, that's a super enticing point you brought up. David, with the First Amendment Coalition, let's get a little First Amendment take here. Carl's saying we really need to draw a line, that there's like real issues here. Do we need to draw a line in that way, or do we need to be protecting this speech?
Well, let me step back for a moment, and I'll just say personally, obviously, I would prefer a world where everyone is always reasoned, civil, thoughtful, and respectful about everything all the time. That's my personal utopia. Unfortunately, we do not live in utopia yet. I also would like to step back, and I certainly don't doubt the very solid research that's been done, that there is certainly an uptick in aggression and incivility in recent years. I'd like to step back for a minute, take a bit of an historical perspective, and reflect that at the same time the Federalist Papers were being published and debated at the highest levels, there were scores, if not hundreds, of anonymous pamphlets circulating accusing Washington, Jefferson, Adams of fathering children out of wedlock. And
it was down and dirty.
I'm sorry?
It was down and dirty.
It's been down and dirty since the founding of the Republic. We had Joseph McCarthy ranting on the Senate floor. We had Spiro Agnew chattering about the nattery nabobs of negativity. So this is not new in our politics. The other point I'd like to make is, without doubting the lived experience that people have to sit through these meetings, oftentimes one person's incivility is another person's speaking truth to power. And norms of civility have been deployed to discredit and silence voices of resistance and dissent. Voices of resistance and dissent to slavery, to disenfranchisement of women, to oppression of people across the board. And by historical norms, yes, it's offensive what occurs in certain public meetings, but we do not have, at least last I heard, anything remotely resembling Preston Brooks beating Charles Sumner to within an inch of his life on the Senate floor in 1856 after Charles Sumner delivered a virulent anti-slavery speech. So yes, we have historical problems. Now, with that all in mind, I would like to preface my thoughts with a few principles. One, there is of course no such thing as a system without costs. A system that prioritizes freedom of speech carries cost. But also, there's also no such thing as power given that is not eventually power abused. And if you don't want your political enemy to have the power to censor speech, then be careful about giving it to your political friends. I'm always immensely wary of the unintended consequences of any regime of censorship that allows the silencing of speech based upon its viewpoint, however repugnant that viewpoint may seem. Because unless there's someone smarter than me who's figured this out, I don't know any way to allow the speech that I prefer without tolerating the speech that I hate. Now, there are limits that can be enforced. The Brown Act and the First Amendment recognizes, particularly in the context of public governing board meetings, Brown Act meetings, time limits can be enforced. People can be required to stay on topic. If they go off topic, they can be cautioned, admonished, and if necessary, removed. If they speak over other people, if they fail to observe the viewpoint neutral rules of decorum that are baked into the Brown Act. You know, they can be cautioned and warned and removed if they genuinely disrupt a meeting. What they cannot be is silenced because people just don't like what they have to say. And that may be offensive and hateful, but again, what was offensive and hateful at one time is now the accepted dogma. Once upon a time, it was hate speech, so to speak, to call for the abolition of slavery. And it was silenced. There was a rule against debating slavery on the floor of the House of Representatives, the floor of the halls of Congress. So be very careful about the unintended consequences of any rule that says we can shut down people because we don't like what they have to say.
Right, right. Thank you for that perspective. Okay, so this is a tricky panel to moderate. I see everybody scribbling notes furiously, and there's four people, so I'm just going to try to aggressively let everybody get their time. So I'm going to come back to you, Supervisor Lawson Reamer. I know there's been some discussion at the Board of Supervisors about maybe limiting Zoom comments. I think that was an option. It got pulled or something at one point. Where are you at with the limiting public comments, you know, in any way that you think might be necessary?
I actually don't think that there is any tension at all, or any contradiction between protecting the broad right of everyone to participate in a meeting and protecting the right of specific individuals to participate in a meeting. I think that those things are quite congruent. And so what I mean by that is I think to David Lloyd's point, it is absolutely vital to be content neutral and viewpoint neutral in any kind of rules that we would put in place for how a meeting is conducted. People have every right to show up and say things that other people might think are hateful. That is an important right to protect. But everybody has the right to participate and make their voice heard. And so our job, I think, at the county is to create and enforce rules that protect all of those rights equally. And that's what we've really been looking at. We've asked county council to take a really careful look at what could we do to better protect everyone's rights to participate in these public meetings. So what does that mean in practice? I think in practice it means when someone is disruptive in a meeting and genuinely disruptive, like they have been told that their time is over limit and they continue talking and talking and talking and then the sheriff has to remove them, that you should not then just be able to walk back in the meeting and do it again, right? That is a disruption of everyone else's right to participate. If you're removed from a meeting, you don't just come, you have to come back into the meeting. Or these kinds of rules around if you have lots of speakers to have time limits so everyone has the opportunity to participate and to make their voice heard. Rules around requiring that people actually speak to the topic and their comments are relevant and that they're not off topic. Because there is a time during the public meetings and that's called non-agenda public comment, where you can come say whatever the heck you want. And that is the purpose, right? Is to say, come and make your voice heard on issues that are not on the agenda. But when you're speaking to a specific agenda item that's really important, that impacts our community, and everyone has a viewpoint and is trying to share it, and we as supervisors are really trying to listen and understand what people are saying, that it's really important that those comments are about that that agenda item. And if it's not on topic, then those comments should be in the appropriate time, which is during public comment. That's the non-agenda public comment. So what we are now looking at is kind of how to better create those kinds of rules that we already have in place, but I think we all think could be a little cleaner and a little clearer in terms of making sure that everyone knows the rules of the road and that those are applied in a way that's even and fair to everyone in a meeting.
Thank you. Well, let's just keep coming right on down the table. Juan, I saw you scribbling away. tell us what you're thinking.
So I'm thinking about like the difference between rules and cultural shift, and like what are some of the things that are in place already that aren't being properly utilized. For example, a lot of times when people go to these public meetings and they're at the point of ranting, there are many commission meetings and other meetings before whatever decision that's about to be made could have been adjudicated that they didn't attend or participate in. And so how do we increase opportunity and awareness of how to actually engage in a way that makes a difference? I mean, because showing up to a meeting and being a spectacle after a vote has already been made, it's great for the media, I guess. But in terms of effectively impacting policy, there are other approaches. I look at, when I talk about cultural shift, I think about the people I know are responsible for like recruiting people to serve on commissions and boards, and how they struggle to one, get people to sign up, two, get people to attend. If like just some of the people that like to fill the halls on the day of like a supervisor or city council meeting, if like just some small percentage of those people would commit to like regular engagement, perhaps they can influence things in a different way. Although I will also acknowledge, having participated in some of these activities myself, that the recommendations of these committees are not always honored. And that's one of the reasons you get the blowback. And so when you think about a social contract, I think part of it is, if you charge people with doing the work to identify a path towards a solution to a problem, that you give some regard to their effort when considering how you're going to approach and respond.
Okay, Carl, we'll come to you. And